Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Real Vision Podcast Network.
It's Wednesday, December 8, 2021. I'm Ash Bennington, joined shortly by Darius Dale of 42 Macro. Lots going on today, as always. Looks like some positive news out of a Pfizer study where the new Pfizer dose, the booster shot, for COVID seems to neutralize the Omicron variant in laboratory testing, and apparently some immunity conveyed in some larger studies that are starting to come out with regard to human populations. Also, the JOLTS report out today, it appears that the rate of the great resignation may be slowing. Specifically, the quits rate has declined. Let's bring in Darius Dale to talk about all of it. Darius, welcome back to Real Vision Daily Briefing.
What's up, Ash? How you doing, man? Where you at?
So I currently am in Las Vegas, Nevada for The Takeover. This is Real Vision's conference with our partner MGM. So we are doing this live from Las Vegas in a hotel room. In fact, I can look out this window here and see the entire Las Vegas downtown skyline. So it's great to be here. And by the way, for people who are interested in The Takeover, this is obviously an event that we're talking about crypto, digital assets, and the importance that this group is playing today and going forward. I believe you can still go and purchase streaming tickets to stream the event live right now from wherever you are at.
Awesome, man. Enjoy that.
So Darius, let's talk, man. Let's talk a little bit about your view of what's happening big picture. I mentioned the jobs report, the JOLTS report from today, and the jobs report, employment situation report from last week. Tell us what's your overall take on the market and why today's data, the JOLTS report specifically, changes or doesn't change your view.
Yeah, no, with respect to the JOLTS data, I saw unpack that in reverse. The JOLTS data did tick down. We saw the quits rate decline by 20 basis points month over month. To 3.1%. That's the lowest number we've seen since June. It's coming off.
Yeah, for people who don't know what the quits rate is, give us a sense of it and why it's important in determining sentiment in the labor markets.
Yeah, so exactly. So the quits rate is the number of people who are leaving their job, obviously, as a function of the total amount of people who are employed as a ratio of the total amount of people. So that's typically the higher that number goes, it's indicative of a lot of confidence among workers in the labor market, that the labor market is hot, it's tight, and that they can obviously get another job. But typically, you change jobs, you quit your job for higher wages, and so the quit rate tends to be very positively correlated with the employment cost index, with wage growth, and things of that nature.
In a pretty intuitive way, too, right? So most people don't quit their jobs unless they're feeling very confident about their ability to get a better job, either at a higher rate or a more convenient job, or a job that you like better that you see has more upward mobility, for example.
Yep, absolutely. So that's exactly the point. And so what we've seen this year is the quit rate really accelerate to an all-time high. It peaked out at 3.3% in August, sort of came in at 3.3% again in September. And then now it's now starting to fade a little bit in October. But again, we're still at very elevated levels. And as a function of that, we've obviously seen something like the employment cost index, which is probably the best measure of wage growth. It's not as timely as the jobs report, because it's a quarterly statistic. But that's still up at an all-time high. At 3.7, or sorry, not an all-time high, 3.7% is the highest number we've seen since the third quarter of 2004.
Hey, Darius, can you talk a little bit more broadly about what this great resignation phenomenon is that we're seeing right now and why it's significant?
Yeah, so that's a great question. There's two things, in my opinion, that are happening in the labor market that I think are both pointing to an accelerated taper and obviously the Fed actually having to acquiesce to what the markets are already pricing in, which is in a more accelerated policy rate sort of tightening schedule. And so one dynamic, you have an acceleration of return to work. And we're seeing this in terms of the slope of the line with something like unemployed workers that take down another 542,000 to 6.8 million. That number, the slope of that really started to accelerate to the downside upon the expiration of the enhanced unemployment insurance. We're also seeing the slope of the labor force accelerate to the upside. So that ticked up a full million in the most recent jobs report in November to 155 million. So those two slopes are now converging at an accelerating rate, and it's sending a signal to the Fed that the labor market is actually healing much faster. But then when you look at some of the other dynamics that are happening underneath the surface, or not even underneath the surface, kind of just really right at the surface, you look at something like the employment to population ratio, that actually accelerated pretty markedly in November. That accelerated 40 basis points to 59.2. And you look at something like the prime labor force working age participation rate, that's accelerated to 10 basis points to 81.8. Female labor force participation rate, that accelerated another 20 basis points to 56.2 in November. So you have a lot of positivity going on in the jobs report. And then I made this comment last week, which is, hey, look, man, this jobs report is actually very, very hawkish, because what it's kind of showing two dynamics. One, it's healing faster than it had been in recent months. But at the same time, we still have this depressed level of labor supply that is contributing to a supply-demand imbalance between businesses and workers. We obviously saw the headline JOATS data tick up back towards an all-time high in the most recent month. And this supply-demand imbalance is very clearly perpetuating wage growth if you look at it through something like median workers, the Atlanta Fed wage tracker, and obviously the employment cost index data that I just cited.
Yeah, your take on this is so nuanced, Harris, and I want to unpack some of these ideas for people who perhaps haven't had an economics class since college. Let's talk through what this means. Labor force participation rate, employment to population ratio. These are important statistics with gauging the size of a labor force. Now, this is kind of a slightly complex thing because it's in two layers. You have people who are in the labor. If you're not in the labor force, you don't qualify as either employed or unemployed. You have to be in the labor force to be counted in either category. Give us a little bit of a sense of what those broader statistics measure and why it's important for investors to understand where the Fed may or may not be going.
Yeah, absolutely. So the number one reason we track the size of the labor force and the changes therein is to understand whether or not the changes in the unemployment rate, the headline, or the sub-unemployment rate indices are actually, as positive or as negative as they sort of appear on prima facie. And so, you look at this jobs report, we saw a massive improvement in the labor force, and we also saw a massive declines in the unemployment rate. And there's some unemployment rates in particular. So obviously the U3 headline unemployment rate ticking down to the low fours is a very hawkish, very positive dynamic with respect to the labor market. When you start to unpack the surface, it's actually healing faster in the places where the Fed has its most attention with respect to its maximum and inclusive mandate. So you look at things like the Hispanic and African-American unemployment rates, those ticked down 70 basis points and 120 basis points respectively in November. These are massive declines. I mean, you're talking like big, jump conditions lower in those statistics. You also saw a pretty meaningful jump condition lower in the high school dropout unemployment rate that declined 170 basis points in 1 month to 5.7%. I mean, these are, this is the kind of, if the Fed was waiting to say, hey, let me make sure that we don't tighten too soon so they can make sure some of these disaffected groups, it's overly sort of impacted groups with respect to the COVID pandemic, have time to get back to the labor market, have time to find jobs, and ultimately, set themselves up from a livelihood perspective. We're now actually starting to see that. And more importantly, you're seeing that in a very accelerated way. And so I think you play the ball forward, what does this mean as it relates to the Fed's reaction function? They're not going to be, they can no longer lean on that sort of secondary mandate, this maximum and inclusive mandate, and say, hey, we could bury our head in the sand with respect to elevated rates of inflation. They're going to have to giddy up the taper. We suspect that they will next Wednesday. And more importantly, they have to set themselves up to hike interest rates as soon as the first half of next year. We think June will be lift off.
Yeah, and so this is really the key point. You frame the narrative big picture here so well, which is what we're talking about here ultimately is what the Fed will or will not do in terms of the withdrawing of the extraordinary accommodative monetary policy that we've had in place, specifically the asset purchases, $120 billion per month in Treasury debt as well as agency debt. Obviously, that for November and December has been drawn down by $15 billion per month. But give us a sense of the big picture of where we are right now with the Fed. Obviously, we've got a Fed balance sheet of around $8.6 trillion that still needs to be unwound at some point. And we have interest rates, the federal funds rate, still in the 0 to 25 basis point range, meaning at or near the zero bound.
Yeah, so big picture is they got to come out and say something different next Wednesday. So you go back to their September FOMC meeting where they released the summary of economic projections. you know, they're around 2.4% core PC for next year, 2.3 for the year after, talking about maybe one rate hike in 2022. I mean, the market is really calling their bluff on that. The market is, you know, currently right now, the euro dollar calendar spreads are pricing in 80 basis points of tightening. So, you know, effectively three policy rate hikes in 2022. And if they get started in June, it's very likely that they will have the time to get to enact three policy rate hikes. I don't suspect they will in terms of our forecast for core PCE, where it will likely be by the end of next year for them to actually pursue the third rate hike. But certainly what these hawkish employment data are suggesting to the Fed that, hey, look, you wanted to take your time removing the punch bowl. You're now going to have to accelerate the removal of the punch bowl. And that may have that clearly has dire implications for asset markets, you know, in terms of, you know, the leadership of cyclical sectors and style factors. Obviously has, you know, implications for the bond market as well, but not the implications that you might think.
We're going to take a quick break and be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know ya at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Welcome back to Real Vision's Daily Briefing. Let's get right back to the top analysis of today's markets.
Right. So once again, back to PCE. Let's zoom the camera out a little bit there and talk about the nature of the dual mandate, what the Fed is trying to get under control. Obviously, maximum employment and stable prices being two things that can move against each other, in fact, traditionally are inversely correlated. Give us a little bit of a sense on where that balance of risk is right now.
Yeah, well, they'd like it to be a little bit more balanced, but unfortunately, the data they're not acquiescing to the Fed's.
The imbalance of risk. It's the imbalance.
Yeah, exactly. It's very much an imbalance of risk. I mean, so we have 4 handle on core PCE. That's their preferred inflation metric. We have 6 handle on headline CPI. Could potentially have a 7 handle as soon as Friday. We're going to get the November CPI data point on Friday. The reality is these numbers are much more elevated relative to a labor market that is now, you know, very visibly a lot stronger than it had been as recently as a couple of months ago. You know, you go back to September, August, you know, July, the labor market was still healing, but it certainly didn't demonstrate this kind of broad-based and inclusive strength that is now demonstrated as recently as November. So that mandate, they just have to acknowledge that they've been slow foot. They're sort of behind the curve. And quite frankly, they want it to be behind the curve, right? This is the whole point of changing their inflation mandate or their inflation target to something that's average and allows them to sort of hit their targets with respect to maximum inclusive employment. So they're getting what they want. They just probably got a little bit more of it on the inflation side. And as a function of that, they're going to have to do something a little bit different with respect to policy.
Yeah, and the maximum inclusive employment is an important point to make. That word inclusive, there have been points in the labor market that have not seen the strengthening historically in other recessions. I'm thinking about the Great Recession, for example, here, where you saw the global financial crisis, where we saw that certain communities were impacted and impaired in labor markets for far longer than the general rate of, for example, employment.
Very true. And the Fed learned from that. You know, quite frankly, I think they've done, for the most part, have done a good enough job. Don't forget, a lot of the inflation that we're seeing, or at least up until the most recent months, had been in pandemic impacted areas. You know, we had a record fiscal stimulus, multiple record fiscal stimuluses, most recently as March of this year. And then we obviously had a record reopening impulse. Obviously, you got the Pfizer booster news today, but that reopening impulse and that fiscal stimulus were one time in nature, but they were very large in terms of perpetuating some supply demand imbalances across global supply chains and things of that nature. One thing that's different now in terms of the most recent inflation data we're getting, particularly in the headline in the CPI basket, median CPI, we talked about this a few weeks ago, accelerated to 7.1% on a seasonally adjusted annualized basis. That's the highest reading we've seen ever. So the inflation pressure in the economy that's coming from, you know, the kind of the great migration, the great, you know, kind of retirement, the great, you know, reimagining of the workers, connection to the labor force, right. That all those dynamics are really kind of creating a supply demand imbalance with respect to, you know, labor, the supply of labor and the demand for it. So it's all starting to perpetuate higher prices in other areas of the economy. And that's something the Fed may have to accelerate its tightening plans or its exit strategy to accommodate.
Hey, Darius, while we're explaining, expanding, unpacking, let's talk a little bit about the metrics that you use to gauge inflation. CPI, obviously consumer price index, PCE, personal consumption expenditures, the preferred measure at the Fed for measuring inflation, and obviously a great deal more variability underneath the surface when you begin to unpack the next level of data. Give us a sense of what you look at, why you look at it, and what you're seeing.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a bunch of ways to slice and dice inflation. So there's market-based measures as well, but sticking to the kind of the economic, the reporting side of things, you got headline CPI that's obviously got a 6 handle on it, could potentially have a 7 handle on it. One thing I've been doing with most economic statistics, it's kind of, it's more or less folly to look at them on a year-over-year rate of change perspective in this particular time period, because we had so much variability with respect to the reaction to the pandemic in 2020 and the second half of 2020. And so it's kind of difficult to glean much from a year-over-year statistic. But when you look at it on a SAR basis, a seasonally adjusted annualized basis, so the month-on-month change times 12, you know, that stuff is, it's actually quite hot. I mean, headline CPI is at 11.9% on a SAR basis. That's the highest number we've seen in that metric since June of 2008. Core CPI is at 7.4%. That's the highest level we've seen since June. These are all October statistics. We're going to get the November data on Friday. You know, something like shelter CPI is up back up at 5.6%. That's the highest we've seen since June. And then when you kind of look towards the more kind of stable measures of employment, I guess, if you will, the measures that exclude, you know, kind of volatile price changes in food and inflation, the Fed's preferred inflation metric, that's at 5.2%. So the SAR is actually running hotter than the year-over-year statistics. And if it stays that way, obviously, the year-over-year statistics will continue to grind higher. So the SAR on core PCE is at 5.2%. In the month of October. So these are all, you know, issues of the Fed, you know, and this is kind of the problem with respect to asset markets, because having waited for so long to kind of commence tightening or commence the removal of the punch bowl and eventually set yourself up, the Fed set itself up for policy rate tightening, they're kind of doing it at a point of the cycle where it's less favorable. You know, so if they had done this whole process, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 months ago, you know, asset markets probably wouldn't have had as much of an issue. Asset markets are unlikely to have as much of an issue with it. But the problem with accelerating the taper, you know, particularly throughout the first half of 2021 and ultimately tightening monetary policy in the first half of 2021, and potentially throughout 2022, my apologies, 2022 when I said all those things, it potentially accelerating, you know, the taper and tightening monetary policy, we're going to have growth and inflation decelerating simultaneously throughout that entire process. And so there'll be tightening into an economic slowdown. There'll be tightening into an inflation slowdown. Now we're coming from very elevated rates of growth, very elevated rates of inflation. So it may be less onerous for markets to chew that up, but there's not a lot of history to suggest that, you know, tightening policy into what we call bottom-up macro regime deflation is something that should be kind of dismissed by investors, particularly with respect to risk assets.
Yeah, let me underline a point that you just made there while we're explaining and unpacking. SAAR, I know it's a lot of acronyms, but what we're trying to do is look at inflation on an annualized rate basis. So Jim, when you see these numbers, when they're adjusted SAAR, seasonally adjusted annualized rate, that means it's the rate at which inflation is running for the full year based on that monthly reading. The other option that you have for this is to look at things year over year, so you don't need to adjust it. You can look at, for example, December of 2021 compared to December of 2020. Unfortunately, with that, you can get some base effects. There really are no perfect metrics to do this, but we can adjust for it and just try and get a sense of globally, big picture, what's the rate of inflation running every year?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, I'll never forget, economics is a soft science. We try to use as much math and data as possible to help investors front run these kind of big pivots in financial markets. But the reality is, you know, you can, investor A can look at the same exact job report as investor B or policymaker A and policymaker B and wind up on two very different conclusions. So never forget that.
It ain't physics or chemistry.
Oh, definitely not.
Yeah. But, you know, over the years, we've developed these statistical tools to get a sense of what some of these things are so you can adjust for it, so you can correct for it. It's especially difficult right now, I think, in the wake of the COVID crisis, when you see this just extreme V-shaped recovery, or maybe the inverse radical shaped recovery, where you drop very steeply, you recover, but then you don't actually get back to par. So these numbers can be, first of all, the magnitude changes that we're seeing. You mentioned it in the labor force participation rate changes. These are huge, huge swings relative to traditional pre-COVID, for example, changes. So it's an important point to point out. And as we look at this and we examine it, you know, people like you, Darius, who've been doing this for a really long time, have developed not just the statistical tools, but also the intuition to know which one to use and why, which is why I think it's so important to have conversations like this on Real Vision, where you can explain and unpack a little bit of your thinking.
Yeah, no, definitely. There's 13 years of gathering knowledge into this discussion. So I appreciate you calling that out.
Darius, if you've been doing this for 30 years, I'd be really impressed, even more impressed than I am today.
Lord knows, what was I doing 30 years? Not much 30 years ago. Not much.
Hey, Darius, let me ask you a question. And I'm not going to ask you the narrow question about what this means for coming out of Pfizer. Obviously, as you're saying at the top of the show, reports that the vaccine offers protection against Omicron, especially when you get the booster shot. This is based on lab tests and I think some limited survey data in the field. You know, obviously, this is a very sort of fluid, dynamic time. In other words, the news cycle moves very quickly. You get these little snippets of news, and then you have to process them and think about what does that mean? How do you process all of this as it comes into you? Do you try and to a certain extent disregard it and stay eye on the ball in terms of data, or do you take into account some of the news flow that's coming at you?
Yeah, no, it's not the news flow that matters to me. It's the data that predicts the news flow, and more importantly, data that might change the news flow. So when you look at something like the jobs report, when we got that jobs report on Friday, you know, obviously the kind of initial hit knee-jerk reaction was like, oh, it missed, it was a huge miss, it's dovish. But then you take a second and go into and do the advanced analytics on what's actually happening underneath the surface. You know, to me, I'm like, okay, that sets us up to understand that, hey, look, you know, investors are initially reacting to this as dovish, but the reality is it's actually quite hawkish in our opinion. And so that's the kind of analysis that we're doing. It's not what the news or the headlines are. Right. It's what is the data and how are the headlines evolve in the next, you know, kind of sequence of weeks, sequence of months, sequence of quarters. That's exactly what we help investors do with 42 Macro.
You know, it's funny. I'm here in a hotel room in Las Vegas. So I don't have all my notes. I don't have all my nerdy stuff that I have in my apartment. But when I read that report on Friday, you know, my first take was, and it's funny, you should mention, so it seems dovish were the initial headlines even breaking on financial news. I read through this report and my big takeaway, the one thing that I remember here at my hotel room in Las Vegas, historical correlations are breaking down. This report has internal dynamics that look very different than other reports that we've seen from the employment situation. There's just a lot of stuff that typically is correlated, typically moves together, or inversely, that isn't moving in that direction now, because we're seeing these changes based on the volatility, massive changes in base effects, and potentially some hysteresis as well.
Yeah. And don't forget the seasonal adjustment as well. That's a big factor as well in terms of the establishment survey. So it's just hard. I mean, it's hard to be. We knew this at the outset of the pandemic. It's hard to be an economist right now. Thank God I'm not an economist. I happen to have a good handle on economics, but. I consider myself more of an investor, a risk manager more than anything. And what we're using is our informed views on changes in the economy and our projections in terms of the changes in the economy to relate that back to what we should be doing from a portfolio construction perspective. So that's all this really is. You know, we can sit here and walk out on jobs report A or B, you know, for the next 6 hours. But the reality is we're not helping ourselves or investors make money with it. It's kind of useless information.
Yeah, that's a great point. In fact, hold that thought. We're going to get back to portfolio construction in just a second because I want to get your take on what this means and how you're processing portfolio construction. But first, to get back to the points that we were making earlier about the Fed, I wanted to jump in here and show a quick clip. This is Maggie Lake and Alfonso Pecatiello from December 6th, talking about the Fed and his take on whether or not it will move soon. Let's take a look at the clip.
I would argue the Federal Reserve will probably be able to taper according to plan. There are, of course, COVID uncertainties going forward. There is a weak credit impulse going forward. On the other end, there is a labor market which is healing. Labor market is healing. cyclically speaking, we have people going back into the labor market. We have U6 unemployment rate, which is a broader definition of unemployment rate, which includes not only U3 classical definition, but also marginally attached people to the labor force, or people that work part-time for economic reasons, for example. All these people basically are trying to get back into the labor force and are even being successful in doing that. So as that happens, cyclically, you will have improvements in the labor market, and that will effectively lend a hand to the consumer side of the equation. So
there you have it. Alfonso Pecatiello sounds to be in agreement with you, Darius. The Fed will probably be tapering according to plan.
Yeah, no, I would take it a step further. He's by the way, great investor, does excellent work. I would take it a step further. I don't think they're going to taper according to the original plan, the plan they laid out on November 3rd that was ahead of. You remember they made that statement, hey, we're going to just watch this thing go $15 billion a month. But since then, we've gotten the headline CPI data point kind of a week right after that, 6 handle, shocked the market. And then we got the core PC data point, 4 handle. Didn't necessarily shock the market to the same degree, but you know, we've gotten 2 very important data points since then. And oh, by the way, the third data point, the cherry on top, was the November jobs report and all the very hawkish internals therein. And so, to me, if you're talking about if you're being Bayesian about this, and I assume this data driven Fed, they keep talking about how data driven they are. If they're being Bayesian about it, the world on December 8th is very different than the world on November 3rd in terms of the incremental information we've gathered to adjust our Bayesian prior to a different posterior state. The posterior state says, hey, look, you need to move faster. And we do think they're going to move faster. And at some point in the kind of the first half of next year, I happen to think it'll be late Q1, early Q2, we're going to get to the point where there's being outright liquidity reductions in markets when you sort of layer on the Treasury General Account and all those dynamics therein. So we're headed for potentially rocky 2022, potentially, you know, very rocky first half of 2022. And ultimately, it's nothing to necessarily do with that today, but certainly from a medium-term perspective, investors are probably reasonably off sides in terms of a lot of the holdings and allocations that they have, you know, just coming off a 2-year kind of massive bull run. Actually, really 3 years if you kind of go back to the start of 2019.
Darius, when you're ready to write it, Being Bayesian is a great title for your memoir.
Oh, man, that's a great one. I might actually steal that one from you. Thank you. Thank you.
We're going to take another quick break and be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Welcome back to Real Vision's Daily Briefing. Let's get right back to the top analysis of today's markets.
Hey, Darius, listen, talking about the cherry on top, let's talk about portfolio allocation. We obviously gave the framework for what you're seeing right now, how you're thinking about markets. Take it down to us to the next level. How do you think about portfolio allocation, portfolio construction in this particular environment?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So this is something we specialize in. We help investors, institutional investors, all the way down to retail investors at 42 Macro with this very specific topic. And, you know, how we think about portfolio construction first starts with, you know, orienting the themes, the bets in the portfolio, you know, kind of across, you know, the 4 different grid regimes that we have, Goldilocks, reflation, inflation, and deflation. We want to orient the size of the bets in the portfolio that correspond to each of those 4 regimes, that correspond to one of those 4 regimes, in accordance with the probabilities of realizing those regimes in the economy over the medium term. And so right now we're, you know, kind of fairly tilted towards inflation with a secondary bias towards deflation and a very minimum sort of allocation towards Goldilocks and reflation. Those are the pro-growth exposures. Those are the pro-growth themes. Those are the themes where you'd be long small caps, you'd be long, poop coin, not to borrow the, you know, curse on the, you know, that's where you'd be long the kind of higher beta, higher risky, low, you know, kind of higher leverage type exposures. You know, when you're talking about having a more overall weighting more towards inflation or deflation, you're talking about lower beta exposure. Not saying you had to go out and raise a bunch of cash and not be involved in financial markets. It's just to say that the kind of exposures you need to have in your portfolio are generally a little bit more defensive in nature.
Yeah. Hey, Darius, we've got some great questions here. I know we're running low on time. Want to do a speed round? I got three questions here. They're just great questions I want to throw out to you because I think they're really interesting and build on what we've been talking about here today. The first one comes to us from Christopher Fearon from the Real Vision site. And the question is, Darius, how are you positioning for the CPI report on Friday? And more broadly, Darius, what are you going to be looking for there and how are you thinking about it?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's pretty well telegraphed that it's going to be hawkish. You know, it could be, you know, we've seen several CPI reports this year, particularly the April and obviously the October CPI reports that were even more hawkish than the hawkish expectation. So you certainly could potentially see that again. Certainly if the seasonally adjusted rate of inflation doesn't tone down, it probably will tone down just given the decline in crude oil we saw towards the end of last month. But if it doesn't tone down, you could see a seven handle really, you know, pop up there and really spook markets. And so one thing we called out in our morning note today is that, hey, look, we sort of ended last week with a really elevated what we call volatility risk premiums in financial markets, so which is the price of protection relative to the realized volatility, relative to recent changes in realized volatility. And that we had very high implied volatility premiums, which means investors were really nervous. You know, they kind of ended the week in a very hedged, nervous state. And obviously, kind of the incremental news we've gotten on Omicron being less severe, that booster shots are working. You know, all that stuff's really perpetuated a lot of that, you know, monetization of those puts, a lot of short covering in the week to date. Now investors are sitting somewhat naked heading into a couple of, you know, what could potentially be very hawkish catalysts. And so, you know, to the extent that investors have monetized those puts and have covered shorts, maybe you want to think about, you know, putting them back on just to survive the next couple of weeks. So that's kind of the near-term setup.
Yeah. Here's one from Chris Ramos. I think he's half teasing us. How high can inflation go before it breaks the Fed's 2% average threshold? What Chris is asking, Darius, is when is seven greater than two?
Most of the time, I guess. I mean, you know, that's a great question. And I'll take it just a quick step further. The bond yield curve has been flattening pretty aggressively, you know, really for quite a long time. If you look at 10s, 30s, 5s, 30s, or even, you know, sort of you know, 10s, 30s, 5s, 30s in particular. The 10s, 2s curve really started to kind of pancake itself in the last week or so. And to me, that's a very new dynamic. And the reason, in our opinion, that's a new dynamic is because it's effectively forecasting that the Fed will be effective in tightening us into an economic slowdown. And so that is a new dynamic that investors kind of have to watch. And so you kind of have to, the key takeaways on these inflation prints, it's like the higher up we go in inflation, the more probable it is all your inflation trades will not work. Because the Fed is going to accelerate its reaction to that in terms of reining out those speculative excesses.
Yeah, very interesting point. Final question comes to us from Ralph Humphrey. He's asking to be a bit of a soothsayer here, obviously, especially with what's going on with the reopening trade. And the question is, where does Darius see oil prices going from here?
Yeah, no, if the COVID, if the Pfizer CEO gets the boosters boosted, and I get the soothsayer soothsaying. So I'm more than happy to soothsay. What I do for a living. You know, so crude oil is bearish from the perspective of our volatility adjusted momentum signal. So the probability is higher that it has a drawdown from here than it does have a recovery. It could recover. I'm not saying it's going to do one or the other. But certainly for now, as an investor, if you're making decisions based on all the information that you have today, the probability is higher that you have a drawdown than it is that you have a massive recovery. I do believe in the kind of longer term bull case in energy. It's been very well laid out by a lot of investors who are much smarter than me on the subject, and I don't have any real reason to push back against that. But the reality is, the one thing, and I'll leave everybody with this comment, GDP growth expectations just isolated in the U.S. in particular, and it's been pretty similar for most global economies. GDP growth, real GDP growth next year is expected to come in at 4%. What is happening in the U.S. economy that makes us grow more, almost double what our trend growth rate is? You know, the trend growth in the U.S. is somewhere around 2.25% in terms of our potential GDP. And so for us to grow, let's call it 175 basis points faster than we normally grow, you need to say, we need to obviously have some very important dynamics that are catalyzing that. In 2022, we have some important dynamics that are actually working against that. So you need to find some, you need to fill that hole, in my opinion. Fiscal drag is likely to be very, very large. And quite frankly, it'll be a record fiscal drag, nothing unlike we've ever seen in terms of, you know, in terms of recorded history. So that's a problem for growth next year. We obviously don't have the sort of same impulse with respect to vaccinations and reopening. That was kind of, it wasn't one time, but we're not going to get, you know, go from 0% vaccinations to 70, 80% vaccinations in 2022 like we did in 2021. And so the kind of the impulse to the positive shock to services sector activity that we experienced in 2021, albeit very disappointing, certainly not what we thought it was going to be, that positive shock, that impulse will be smaller in 2022. So you have two very big things working against growth next year. At the same time, consensus growth expectations are still very elevated. So to me, I think we could be on a collision course next year for some real volatility. Again, don't have to run out and do anything with that today, as long as you're positioned accordingly to what we're, you know, how we're positioned in the 42 macro portfolio. But eventually we're going to start to have to raise cash and really anticipate some more volatility. So stay tuned on that.
Yeah, that's the perfect biggest big picture to end on right there, Darius. I should probably point out that we're talking about the real rate of growth and trend rate of growth, 2.25 versus the 4%. This is basically factoring out inflation, so the real rate of growth of the U.S. economy.
Indeed.
Darius Dale, always a pleasure to have you with us.
Always, man. Appreciate you, Ash, and enjoy Vegas.
Thank you. Thanks for watching the Real Vision Daily Briefing, everyone. I'll be back again tomorrow in person from MGM with Maggie Lake. The conversation, of course, continues on the exchange. And I believe there are still tickets streaming to get this event, the takeover from the MGM Grand Hotel in Las Vegas right now. Thanks again for joining us.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.